Hi, and welcome back to Bjorfrid's Brewers Roundtables. Would you believe we're up to episode 6 now? And for this, we're back to the Brewers, and we have a great selection. We have Killarney Brewing, Bullhouse from Northern Ireland, and Lionman. Bullhouse, the three guys there took part, so they're listening in and taking part together. It was a lot of fun. We had a lot of chat again. We had great input from the audience, where we actually listened out for where we started getting into encouraging various listeners to hurry up and drink their beers because they were going, the hops were deteriorating in the fridge as they spoke. It was a lot of fun. We had a great session, and I think you'll enjoy it again. One thing I do need to tell you is that we had a little technical difficulty at the start of this one. Basically, people couldn't hear or see us, and we don't have a recording of what we were talking about. So we had to basically restart again. So that's why what you hear at the very start of this is just a mention, a reference to that, and then back into talking about particularly the red ale that Mike from Killarney had that he had been discussing just before we realized that nobody could actually hear us. I don't think it destroys anything. There's not much missing. So see what you think. Here, listen to this. It's going to be fun.
I feel like we should have entered with, and that is the secret to craft beer.
Mike, tell us about this beer, because you were telling us at the start and then you got caught.
Yeah, and nothing was coming out there with it. So yeah, this one, like I think you touched on, it's more traditional, and I think about it that in the sense of the taste is, in that its color is red, its flavor is malty but not sweet, and that's a big point I want to try for with that, because I don't, you know, from what I've read of Irish red ales, like they weren't something that would have been particularly sweet. So, you know, in that sense, it's traditional, but for the beer, for the brewing, it's more modern. And that one of the things I think that makes that beer is the Red X malt from Best Maltings in Germany. It's relatively new, maybe about 10 years ago, in the last 10 years it came out. And for that, it really gives that depth of maltiness, but also that color, which, you know, I really, in all the pilots that we did before we came out with that, it was always trying to get that color right, where it wasn't too copper or too amber, but it was red. And you know, that was a big part of that beer is using the Red X in that.
Yeah, I think the color of it, my eye first, like it's a little bit lighter than what you normally expect, you know, yeah. when you're kind of getting a red ale, you know, the normal way of a red ale just be a bit of black malt or roast barley.
Exactly, you know. Yeah.
So it's definitely, yeah, it's really, the color is lovely. It's very sessionable.
Yeah, no, trying to keep the ABV down to make it that sessionable strength is important with it too, I think, because that's what you want to be for it, I think. But yeah, I mean, and the hops in that are just Goldings. So, you know, it's trying to keep it at a low level, you know, the, you know, 15 minute addition at the end and then the beginning of the boil and that's it. But trying to balance out any kind of maltiness with it.
Mm. It's nice, really clean,
but not going beyond that.
I think some of the issues I have with the straight ale is, like, you know, the BJCP descriptions,
yeah,
things like diacetyl and all this included in it, yeah. And carbon bombs. I mean, it what they describe is septic, you know. It's
yeah.
No, it's good to break out of those types of molds, I think, with it in little ways, because I would never find that a tasty beer with the diacetyl in it.
Yeah,
it'd be too much.
Is that like how you did that? Is that going to be dictated a lot by the fact that you're in Killarney? There's a lot of tourism. Do you have to kind of tailor it?
Yeah, I mean, truth be told, with that beer, like it's not like I really like it, and you know, it's not a huge seller for us. It was starting to pick up for the pandemic, and then I think that quashed it a little bit. It does, like within our pub here in the tap room. You know, it definitely drives a lot of Americans towards it because they're in Ireland and they want to drink an Irish red. So that certainly does fill that, you know, outside of Killarney, it's not a huge seller, but we're trying to push it more in bottle now out at some shops more, and we'll see where that goes. It was starting to sort of take off on draft for us because I think places were looking at it as a craft alternative to Smittix. But then that got crushed by, we made one batch of it last year. I think you're probably right to a degree that being where we are does drive a little bit of that, and we're able to get by making that beer on a regular basis.
Right. So talking about the COVID, I mean, you would have been hit probably the hardest of the three of you by COVID, because you didn't. It was all on site, was it?
No. Most our difference is that we're very heavy on draft beer, because the effort that's been put in over the years to be in the pubs down here for the tourist trade has been great until there's no more tourists and the pubs are closed. So that hit us pretty hard with that, and that outside here at the brewery, there's the stacks of kegs we have sitting around. Can tell that, but yeah, I mean, that's our we were heavy on draft for us compared to most breweries in Ireland, I'd say. Yeah. And that hurt us a bit with that. So we've been trying to make that up with our bottle sales. And getting into cans too soon.
That's the ironic thing, I think, about being a brewery in Ireland, is the draft is so difficult that whenever COVID hit, a lot of the smaller guys, because we're all set up for small pack anyway, we're producing the majority of our beer in bottles and cans because there's very little, of a draft market. It was a bit of a blessing in disguise for breweries in Ireland, or small breweries in Ireland, because you look at breweries in England and stuff, that a lot of the smaller breweries start out focused very heavily on that, and don't have the infrastructure for doing the small pack. They were hit really hard. So, I guess that was one blessing to come out of the COVID thing.
Yeah. And do you think
something I'd add with the drafting is, I think that is true, and I think what we've been lucky with over the years is being down here, there has been that element of, a pub in this area with the tourist trade, people do ask for local beer. Mm-hmm. So, it helped us get our foot in the door, because they would be looking for something, they'd hear these people coming through the door asking, what's the local beer? And that's, I think, part of the bigger benefit of crafts or small brewing around the world. People drink local now, and that's more of a bigger picture. And that helped us with the draft accounts, I think, because we were there to do that for a lot of these pubs. As soon as someone came asking, we had a tap line in there, and we were quick to move on that. So, mostly you've been to Killarney, it's touristy, and it's helped us to be in these pubs that mostly are dominated by Heineken and Diageo.
Yeah. And do you think that'll stay? Because I've been hearing, on the other sessions we have, that people are saying that they're worried that when the whole draft, the whole pubs reopen, that Heineken and Diageo will just basically buy the bar taps and kick everyone else off.
I'm not privy to that side of the conversation. I don't know what that is, but the one thing I would say, definitely through the last summer when things did open in a limited way, one of the things we saw was people going back to what they're comfortable with drinking. People were less willing to, on draft here at our tap room, we'd have small batch. We have a one keg at a time brew magic. We'd do some wackier stuff, and we had trouble shifting that because people would come in and just drink the new stout or the new, the lager. Mm. And I feel like that was just, I don't know if it was a reflection of the bigger thing with the pandemic, that people just wanted to be comfortable.
Yeah.
Familiarity of something they were drinking or what, but.
Yeah. I think it's the other that flipped the coin as well. When the pandemic happened, a lot of people started trying a lot of new stuff as well that they never tried. Especially Gills in a can, there's a lot of cocktail companies which is popping up. Do you know what I mean? A lot of sort of compounders and a lot of mixologists who are selling from nightclubs and stuff. And people are just jumping on the cocktail train, which is really, I know it's a bit off topic with beer. But yeah, people wanted that sort of sense of being in a bar in their own house. What I mean? And that's why
you can see that being another night in, you want to try something new.
Yeah. And that's why I'm just why did the surgery can Guinness not come in? Why did I hit that straight away last year, 12 months ago, and capitalize on that? But we noticed, we definitely noticed people were trying a lot more different stuff, and with the definitely online orders and things.
Yeah, there's a lot of people locally who were buying beer and saying, I've never had your beer before, but we're all about supporting local now during the pandemic sort of thing, which was always good.
Yeah.
I think also just steering this back around to the malt thing, what you guys were mentioning earlier, we were talking a little bit offline about the Marzen you did, and I think overall, in the sense of malty beers, it's sort of what we talked about. They're a hard sell to a degree.
Yeah.
The red ale isn't one of our best sellers by far. It's a hard one to sell. You know, we used to make a Marzen we were talking about, but that we just stopped making it because for whatever reason, I think it's a hard sell to sell malty beer.
It's not really like in vogue at the minute. They're like, poppy beers kind of sewn it up.
Sales, like the fashion follows America, right? And over there, lagers are, you know, again, for probably the fourth year in a row, they're saying, you know, lagers the next big thing, you know, but it's IPA still a big thing, right? Yeah. But the problem we have here is we've got access to such, like guys were saying up there, we've got access to such good lagers here from the continent. Like, it's very hard to go out and compete against that, you know? It's the same.
We have to charge more as well. That's the thing. Like, our cost of production is higher, so it's like you get the local offering of like a really traditional German style, and it's more expensive than the actual original.
And also, like the duty, like obviously UK duty that we pay in Northern Ireland, and your duty are amongst the highest in the in Europe. And you can buy beer directly from Germany and pay the German duty on it and get it delivered to your house. There's no way we can compete with that.
So you have to kind of focus on the being local.
I suppose like with the margin and stuff, it's kind of an indulgence on our part. It's like, well, we just want to make it, and like it's not going to sell as well as the other stuff, but like we want to make it, we want to drink it, but you can only do that every so often. Like, obviously you have to sell stuff.
You're the same as me. I do the Undertone dark lager because I want to have it in the fridge here, so
we're trying to sell it, you know. Marilyn Savage is looking to come on, so I'm going to ask him to pop up. He has something to say.
Hello.
Lawrence.
Hello.
Hello. We can hear you. Yep, we can hear you. We can't see you, but we can hear you.
Well, it should be soon anyway. It's mainly a question for the whole house. Is there any chance you'll bring it back?
We lost you there. We only got the two. Well, I can't say it for definite, but what we do have at the moment is that we are doing another empty stout in the people from Dubliner kindly give us 5 barrels of fresh washed barrels, and we're literally just aging those at the moment out in our barrel store. We have 1,000 liters of an IPA stout in fresh Dubliner casks.
It went down at about 8%, I think. We'll get it tested after it comes out of the barrels. But it won't be exactly an El Capitan, but it'll be something as long as
El Capitan was used with the barrels.
But El Capitan will come back, so at some stage we'll brew it again. We're trying to think of other beers that we'll brew again, but we'll bring it back at some stage. So.
Keep an eye out.
Do you know anybody who can do this barrels?
Thanks, Aaron. There's just one more question before maybe we move on to the next beer, which is someone had a question here. They missed it. Paul was wondering where red and the red ale come from? What malts? I think you already addressed this, but we might have been broken down at the time.
I mean, I would say, so our beer, it's a mix basically of pale malt and red X. That's where we get most of the color from. And then with the last little bit comes from a touch of crystal and melanoidin malt, which I like using as well. That's most of the color from that.
And you said the red X is new.
I would say in the last 10 years it came out. It's not one of these malts that's been around forever, like a Carapils or something like that.
Right.
I want to say they probably did, but it's a German malt from Best Malting.
Okay, so look, we went into all our things here. Maybe we'll get on to yours, Mark. Your idol, which you were explaining, is doesn't fit into any category at all.
A mongrel, yeah.
Maybe you should have called it.
Any other questions?
Have you guys tried this one? What did you think of it?
What?
No, I'm just asking if the other guys have tried this one.
One thing about it I thought was just amazing, like how drinkable it is for its strength. You know, that's really amazing. Like, it really gives that balance of the malt hop kind of character.
Thanks, Mike. I think like I generally make beers on the higher side of ABV as a rule, and I think like one of the things I always try to do with them is getting the finish quite dry again. So, like your beer saw a clean fermentation and a dry finish, and you know you can be surprised what you're picking, you know. So I think one of the big issues we had with this beer was we called it a red IPA for the want of, we have to put it into some category, right? But it's not. It's not like a red IPA because it's not full of crystal malt, right? There's very little malt in this at all. And I think, you know, I found it hard to describe. But really what I did was I took an Irish red ale approach to an IPA was what I tried to do with it. And you guys probably know yourself that when you start putting the darker crystal and stuff like that into a hoppy beer, it runs down the hops very quickly. It takes over, you know, faster. So it's a beer that you really, if you want to get it hoppy, you have to get it really fresh. And after that, the malt over, you know? So,
It's really clean again. Yeah. And the good body to it as well.
Yeah, it's got a very soapy, my favorite. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. It's so clean like that. It just goes right down like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'd second that with the crystal. Like, we make our red IPAs, the Scarlet Pimpernel we do. And that's another one. Like, you know, over the years, I've just cut back every little bit crystal in it because it just takes so much away from the hops.
Yeah, it's weird, affects the hops so much. You can taste it out of the tank. You're going, wow, it's an IPA. We can sell this as an IPA. Yeah. And 3 weeks in the can, and it's just like it's a red, you know. So it's a tricky one to balance. We did another red imperial called Rabbit Hole after this, and I think that one was about around 8%, but like we really laid the hops on heavy on that one, and like it was delicious, fresh. It's only out probably about 2 months, so I don't know how it laid, but I expect it'll go the same way, you know. Like it'll deteriorate very quickly because of the dark malt in there, you know.
Yeah.
So do you recommend then that's one you have to drink as soon as it hits the shelves?
I think the IPAs, you need to drink them fresh. I think the paler the IPA, the longer it'll last.
Okay. We've got a black IPA going at the minute, and it had like I think 15 kilo dry hop in it. So but we're basically doing like a New England take on a black IPA. But already you can kind of see from the hops going in fresh, and you got that, you know, super, like when you smelt it, the roastiness was there to a certain extent, but it's like pale beer with a bit of roastiness in the back end. But as it's conditioned, it's just all that like fresh, fruity hoppiness is really just taking a back seat, and the roastiness comes through. So even in, you know, the space of a few weeks, you can see that change. Obviously it's darker, it was chocolate malt than that, but you still get you do see that sort of deterioration, not deterioration, but the hops take a back seat and the malt really comes through. So it's probably more along the lines of like a hoppy porter now. And we use like a Sanders, like a London Fog ale yeast in it, so it's got all the fruity estuary stuff when you taste it, but it's just all malt on the nose.
It's very deceiving as well when you're looking at a black beer, a very dark beer, and smelling it's like this hop aroma coming, all these like sort of fruit punch bowl sort of tutti frutti things, and it always catches you off guard. This is because that's the first black IPA we've ever done.
There's a couple out at the moment, actually. I know that Wicklow Wolf did black IPA, and I'm trying to think, I think Third Barrel did one as well. It'd be interesting to pick one up and see how it holds up, if somebody's found a way to kind of keep the hops in the forefront on them. I don't know what the science is behind it, but just my experience is that they do really kind of go off a cliff. The darker it is, the quicker it goes down.
Yeah,
it depends how you're getting the color into the beer as well, in terms of the malt that you're using, and that's you know, how dark you want to go, and how much how far down the malt really go in terms of
the more dark, bitter, roasty malts, obviously I think they'll just like completely cut through the hop anyway. You can't really pair those with hops, because it just, you'll only taste the bitter roasty malt, you won't taste the hops.
I think the weird thing is that it seems to affect the aroma more than the flavor, you know. That's what really kind of melts my head, you know.
I'd say the same thing. Like, I find on our red IPA, it just goes downhill fairly quickly, and it's not that it's bad couple months in, it just changes to a different beer.
Yeah. I think we get spoiled as well, though, because we're, when you get it fresh, when you get it the freshest, like straight out of the tank or whatever, when you're taking your samples, you want it to just stay like, you want to like freeze frame it there. You're like, this is class, right? Yeah. Freeze frame this. This is what goes out. And unfortunately, it doesn't quite work like that.
But yeah. How then for you? Like, you've got it where you think it is, and then you know that maybe someone mightn't drink it for 6 months. What are you going to do?
Yeah, well, that's it. That's just the part and parcel, isn't it?
You can't do anything about that, really, Brian. I mean, we're not Diageo. Like, we can't pasteurize our beers and make them for shipping around the world. You know what I mean? It's we're small breweries. Our stuff is unfiltered, uncentrifuged. We don't use finings, really, generally, in any of the beers. So, like, once they're going to go into the can, they're going to change. And it's like any kind of fresh product. You know, it's going to change. You need to... I mean, not necessarily for the worst. I mean, it might change for the better. You know, it depends. You know, like,
sometimes that happens for sure. Like a couple of weeks in calm, and then you're getting flavors from like a hoppy New England. You get different flavors from when it was in a tank, better flavors sometimes as well. Yeah. So it does work both ways.
Yeah, but people kind of expect that with, say, I don't know, the, you know, spontaneous fermented beers and stuff. They know that they're aged and that they change, but do they really expect it like on something like Idle or you know, your
PA? I actually think you should expect it more on those sort of beers, because like something like a spontaneous fermentation that's had 3 years in a barrel is going to have stabilized out a lot more than something that's come out of a tank and been fermented 2 weeks ago. Especially with lots of hops in it. Like, the hops are the first thing that's going to take the hit, you know.
But especially with a New England style where all your hops are going in during or towards the end of fermentation, and those are like the most volatile things. Like sometimes you see beers with like 3 month sell by date or a 6 month sell by date on them, and that's just basically they're saying, we can't say that this is going to taste as it should beyond that 6 month period, so we don't want to put a 12 month sell by on it. We want you to get it, drink it fresh.
You definitely notice after 3 months of deterioration.
We started on the best before dates, guys, because it wrecks my head. We've had to destroy beer, right? Because we put a best before date on it that the distributors wouldn't take, right? There's nothing, the beer, like, this best before is a concept. I don't know, like, I understand the ones by use by, right?
Yeah.
Where it's going to poison you if you don't eat it. But on something like a beer, why don't they have best before dates on one, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's a problem, and it's like they treat the beer like a can of beans or something like that.
Yeah. You
know,
yeah.
So many of these distributors, it's like that. The way it's treated is, it's not how good it is. It's, you know, they want a number, they want a date in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, last week we were talking cider, and I can't remember the exact details. I'd have to go back, but there was some reason, and if you did it in some way, you didn't have to have a best before date on the cider. If you skipped that stage or you didn't do this thing, then you had to have a best before date, and it didn't seem to make much sense, really.
I got a can of beer recently, and it had 10 years best before date on it, right? So, which I thought was genius, and I was kind of a mind, right from now on, I'm just going to put a package date on it. And a 10-year best before date on it, right?
Be tempting them.
Yeah.
Definitely would be.
And I think for one of we used to do an Imperial Stout at Christmas time, aged in barrels, and it was a quest for the Milky Way, and we put about 5 or 10 years on the best before. Just because it's going to get better, you know, in 20 years' time, if it oxidizes, you're going to get loads of nice sherry flavors, and you know, it's going to keep getting better.
Is it purely up to you to decide what the best before date is?
Or it's completely arbitrary. You just pick it out of thin air, basically.
Decide on the day when you're setting up the label. I would be able to come on this
way. Depending on the standard.
The packaging date would be
I'd agree. I wish, you know, ultimately, like, we're limited in our packaging line right now, but I'd like to be able to have, you know, the ability to put two lines like that where it's sort of the day it was packaged on, and so people know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It also helps you as well, but because there's a lot of things that can happen over a day, not like colossal things, but just with packaging and running to the can line, if anything ever goes wrong, just knowing that can date, you can pinpoint stuff that might have happened, whether it might have been overcarbonation, if that would have been head pressure in the tank and there had been absorbed carbon dioxide, and it would have maybe sort of carbon a wee bit too much, and then you're wondering why that was packaged that way. I mean, these wee things all help for us as well.
Yeah.
Also great having the can on date just for the consumer. Absolutely.
Yeah, now I think that's one of the things I there's so many educated, you know, beer drinkers out there, and you can make your own decision.
Yeah.
I think rather than having a best before date, if you at least have both on there, and you can be like, okay, this is an IPA. I personally don't like drinking them past 2 months. Malty red ale, I'll give it 4 or 5, you know, kind of thing. So people can make the decision. So I think you're definitely trying to do more of that. The packaged on date or the born on date kind of.
Well, I definitely appreciate it. Like, if I'm in a bottle shop or whatever, I like to know how fresh it is generally, and the best before date's only half the story, isn't it?
Yeah.
Best before date's only on a beer is that if you can kind of infer what the packaging date was from it, maybe. You know, like, but 9 months, 6 months, 12 months, you know, and that's about it. You know, it's useful beyond that, if you ask me.
Yeah, that's true.
It's a common thing. Like, here, back, you know, we always have, back before the pandemic, when we had all the tourists through, like, a lot of times I'll hang out at our tap room here, and the amount of times, one of the first things I always tell American, like, when you have like American people who are really into beer and they're asking about that, I'll tell them, like, look, most beer, if you look at date, that's probably a year, and that's not the norm in the States. Like, you might have 3 months, 6 months, never more than that, really. So that's always one of my first warnings to them when I tell them to go down to the bottle shop down the street, is just like, when you look at that, just keep in mind it's probably a year, because that's most common here. And, you know, as a warning of that, whereas, like, they're going to look at it and think it was 3 months ago, and I'm like, yeah, you're going to be really disappointed. That hazy IPA was
Mike, I'll tell you the reason why they put a year on them, right, is because the importers won't take beer with less than 9 months left on it, right? And in Italy, like, it's 12 months plus. So if you put 12 months on your can, if you don't have a forward order on that, you're not getting into Italy. Like, so it's, you know.
Yeah.
We had that thing with actually an Italian distributor using currently, and which is first thing we ever came across, where there was like, can you send us a beer that has that has been packaged for 3 months? One of your holiday beers. And that was the first time we ever experienced that. I was like, that's actually a really good way of identifying the freshness of your beer and how you're doing,
and how it holds up. Yeah,
how it holds up, and that was really cool. And I was like, I actually respect that. The fact that that is like a really big sort of input both for quality in itself. She was like, give us a 3 month hoppy beer, and then we'll talk. And I was so lucky enough, our beer holds up over 3 months.
Well, 3 months in one day after that,
3 months after that
first day,
and then it's gone to shag after that.
Right, well, I'd see that Lars there, or Lawrence, says he still has two, Mike, he has two holes, or Mike, he has two rabbit holes in the fridge. Maybe he should hurry up and start drinking them.
Definitely, drink them now. No, Lars, get them in before dinner. It's the life of the party at the house.
And you have it here, scientific proof that you have to do it, like, there's no argument. So guys up in Belfast there, what ones are ye? Would ye want?
Yeah, we sent down Big Accident, which is packaged actually. What was it?
It was
canned on the 31st of March. So pretty 10 days ago, 11 days ago. So it's a double IPA, which we didn't have any of our. Our standard, like, kind of 6% and 7% IPA. So, this is an 8% double IPA that we sent down to the guys. One of our core beers is Small Axe, which is a session IPA, 4.3%. This is it's not quite the same recipe double, but it's essentially that's the plan was it's double Small Axe. The dry hop.
Oh, you got a Merc Brew?
That's what I ended up getting too.
We'll get some work from this summer.
To be fair, that Mark Brew was packaged in January, so that's going to be a good test, because that was 3 months, 21st January, maybe on that count.
Yeah, it was. I think it was 21st of January. Yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah, from memory. So yeah, so we wanted to test out this 3 months shelf life thing. So Merck Brews is 6.5% New England, and yeah, it's got Galaxy, Simcoe, and Mosaic in it. So yeah, we it's one of our core beers. So we actually we have some tank at the minute ready to package, but that was the I think that was the last batch we did in January, so hopefully it's held up okay.
The great thing is when he brought the Big X in, I think this is a different beer than we're supposed to be in. I didn't think anything. I was like, maybe just bring a Big X just because it's 8%, and we're not gonna get a steam on. I don't know. And then I was like, oh, as soon as you guys said, I was like, I fucking knew this was a different beer.
But yeah, so Mark Bro, standard kind of New England, it goes really well for us. So hopefully it's held up okay. Laura actually in the comments asked a question about getting beer into the south, and for Northern Irish it's actually weird because it's very rare to see beer from the south up here on the shelves, and seeing vice versa, there's only a few breweries, you know, send beers over, you know, both ways, and it's because I guess the importer has to pay the duty on it, so when you have to find a distributor. We can't just say we had a bar in the dock wanted to order a keg off us. We can't just drive that down to the border and sell it to them. The bar in the dock would have to import and pay the duty on it in the south, and we would have to send it under EU movement of goods, and we'd have to have a movement guarantor as well. So it's not as simple as just sending the beer down. You know, you have to have a distributor. So we have a distributor lined up, but we've just been hopefully have an order with them this month, so we'll hopefully get some kind of pallet down in the not too distant future. It's actually one of the benefits of the protocol in terms of Brexit for breweries based in Northern Ireland is that we're still part of the single market, so we can send our beer to Europe as normal. So we picked up distributors in Spain and Italy on the back of Brexit, which has been good, and hopefully picking one up in the Netherlands as well. But we still got one in the south, so you know, it makes more sense to send it to the south than it does to send it to Italy. But
down south is like the first place that we try to get in as well. Like knocking on the door, and then like other things are happening faster.
No, nope. So it's like, yeah, it'll be now. Cool.
Yeah. Rather be down the road, like, but okay.
Yeah, that's a bit strange.
Yeah. But yeah, hopefully within the next couple of months we should have
some. I'll just go back. You couldn't legally get a keg to Dundalk. You probably could, knowing the guys in Dundalk.
Yeah, yeah. No comment.
But we have done a few bits and pieces. Like back at the start of 2019, Shane Long from Franciscan Wales set us up on a road trip around Ireland. We did a 7-day tap takeover, different pubs around. So we started in Galway. Second night was in Dingle. And the Mark Brew beer, Mick, to my right here, your left, actually used to drive an old Mercedes, and that was on the trip. On the second night down in Dingle, the Mercedes broke down, and Mick had to sit on the back of a keg for the rest of the trip around Cork, Waterford, Wexford, Dublin, and then back up to Belfast. So that's the name of this beer came from that trip.
And then I had to, like, 3 weeks later, go down and get that fucking car as well via public transport, which was shite. Yeah, so.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
But I guess it'd be good to get your guys' take on this.
Yeah, that was the last couple of cans I found there as well. So,
yeah.
Let's see. We're in luck finding a couple there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got a little less hops and more like nose, had some of that cherry puree me in it.
Oh yeah.
You know, well, that it had it, and it was a little, but you got more in the flavor, I'd say. I would say the one of the things that was great about it, the drink in terms of drinkability, was the body was amazing. And I guess it's one of your core beers, like whatever you guys are doing with the malts in there and the fermentation, it's really nice.
Mm.
It's definitely got that really chewiness to it. It's really
awesome. So I think there might be a
We actually noticed that we moved breweries or moved location back in September, and previously we were out in Newton Ard, so about 10 miles east of Belfast, and the water, the mains water supply comes from the Moore Mountains and Lough Water, and then you move into Belfast, and it's kind of medium hardness, medium sort of towards the hard side of things, and it's coming from Loch Ney. So we noticed we had to change things in terms of the water profile quite a bit.
Yeah.
So that was something.
Back to square one on the salts and stuff, but yeah. I think we've got, it didn't take too long to get it dialed in again. I think it's pretty much there or thereabouts now. So
it was very strange at the start because we noticed it coming from very soft water. When it was like the HLT, just like that build-up that you get. It's so weird. Like, that's the first time we've ever been introduced to hard water. And even with, like, kettle elements and stuff, I'm like, wow, this is really weird. It gives more of, like, an indication, like, how...
The amount of lime scale
can build up with hard water and how it actually can affect everything. Like, you can visually see it. Because you can see it, obviously, like, you can taste it. But when you visually see it, you're like, wow, that's actually pretty amazing. So...
Yeah.
And from soft water to hard water, it was
How did you try and adapt to that then? Did you change your ingredients or did you try and adapt water to change the water?
So we would always have changed the water profile with the addition of salts and different salts. So we just had to scrap what we were doing up in Ards and then just work it out again down to suit down here. But there are calculators and things you can use that kind of give you a bit of a bearing as to what to start with, and then you can tweak it from there.
So
just being a process of tweaking it slightly, but it didn't really, it wasn't that, you know, it didn't take that long to get it back to where we were happy with it. So
you don't have an RO filter
with the harder water, you tend to end up with a more drinkable beer a lot of the time.
It's probably reducing the amount of salts rather than before we were using a lot of salts with the software, so you know it's taking things out. But using a lot less gypsum than we used to, and the chloride to sulfate ratio is heavily skewed in terms of chloride on nearly all the beers that we're brewing.
Probably notice it more in pails.
Yeah, our water down at the brewery is really soft. Like it's fantastic water to start with, but when I was brewing back home, brewing like the water at the house was like mint coming out of the tap, you know. Everything, so like, I mean, I was doing everything with RO water when I was home brewing, and then adding the salts in from there. But it's great to have a good starting water, you know, makes life a lot easier.
It's a huge challenge. Like that's what I mean. One of the things I'm so relieved. Like with the new place that we're moving to, it's still in Killarney and it's on the same water system. And the enormous burden that's gone of not having to do what you guys had to go through of like switching your water source like that when you move.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not, it's just one more thing you don't have to worry about of like switching the other side of town, but we're still on the same water system.
I'm guessing the water's pretty soft down there, is it?
It is, yeah. There's very little minerals and anything. So, like you guys were saying at Bull House, so I'm adding salts for a lot of the beers. Everyone's got a different profile like that.
It's one of those things that you don't realize. You knew it was going to come up when you're moving premises and when the water changes, but you're like drastically it has to, how it changes the beer. It's actually a very, it's amazing to see.
The spectrum really.
Kind of helps you sort of evolve as a brewery again. You're like,
it's challenging.
Yeah, it's a good thing. Yeah, absolutely.
But if you don't have to do it,
and you at the same time. It's like, I wish we didn't have to change our water supply.
But water from the Moor Mountains sounds a lot more appealing than water from Loch Ney.
good water, cannon water. Good water, cannon water. Yeah. Good for Farrell,
so hard water for the cannons.
Yeah, they're using all our bloody water with these water cannons up in the north.
Be a hose man soon.
Gonna be a hose man.
Be a shortage. I just saw something here because just go off the topic again, just on cans and beers and packaging, like that's come up a few times, is that, you know, the move from bottles to cans has been, I think, surprised a lot of people that it's a demand. But I'm just seeing here Carl Mark O'Neill, who knows something about, you know, retail, is on about that maybe pint cans or pint and going back to bottles.
What's the fixation with size? Good, you know, it's
Yeah. Hey, what would Freud have to say?
Carl Merck, do you want to just qualify that? He's saying the can's 440 mil, as the bottle is 500, and
you know, in a pub talking about the full pint, which is 568, and why don't we have 568 mil cans? So is there any good reason for it? Or is it just pricing or getting a price point?
We don't have pricing, I don't know. Availability
of the cans and stuff as well. And a lot of the machines are set up for 440 because it's a Europe, like standard across Europe. I guess the Barber, one of the breweries over in Bristol, do pint cans and it goes well for them. But you generally, it's harder to source the cans. During the pandemic, it's been hard enough to source cans without having to find 568 mil cans.
Yeah. With the shortage of just raw materials during the pandemic, we it was harder to get cans. Obviously, a lot of the big macro breweries were only selling in cans. So that therefore there was a spike in demand. So there was less raw materials be able to make in cans. Mm-hmm. So there was a time where we were like, we're going to struggle to actually get a pallet of cans here because all the big breweries are like just taking them. Yeah. So, I mean, just
the prices go up well, or is it just a lack of availability?
No, the prices didn't actually go up. It was just more availability. Yeah, it was kind of like thankfully the price didn't go up. Yeah,
even the macros use 500 mil cans. They're not using 565 or whatever. It's 568. You know, so it's to be honest with you, like if you're putting something that's 6 or 7 or 8% a can, I actually think 440 is probably pushing the boundary as it is, you know, that it's not quite a point. And then it's a trade-off. Like, if you put stuff into... We do all our stuff in 440s purely for simplicity. Like, all our stuff is the same size just for pallets and everything. But you're putting stuff into 330s. Like, if that's your go-to size, like, I still think that's a fine size for, you know, if you're having an 8%.
Yeah. And the pricing's going to be proportionate as well. Like, we did big stout, over 10% stout called outside a while back, and in a 440 can, like, it's pricey, you know, with a 10%, you know, high duty mark, the cost, just the per unit cost at that serving size is actually pretty high.
So like, 7 or 8 quid, I think, for a can. And if you're going into a bar to be having 440 mils of that, of a 10% MP stout, you're going to have a third of a pint, maybe.
Yeah.
You're not going to be, I mean, you know, you wouldn't be having 2 thirds, or, yeah, you'd never have a pint of that in a bar.
Yeah,
I think pricing is probably not the biggest concern really with craft beer, because if people want, it's like most craft beer drinkers aren't out trying to get, you know, stuff is, you know, but they want to get something nice to drink. So I think pricing is a secondary concern over the quality. And I think it's just, you know, you guys are saying, it is availability, really. That's what it comes down to. We've got two options from our canners, 33 or 440, 330, 440, and that's, we just go with 440. And you have to do, like the guys are saying as well earlier on, you have to do the labels up, you know, week lead time on your labels and stuff. It's just simple. It just keeps things simple, really, is the answer.
Yeah, it's also like there's also that sort of thing where the consumer feels that they're getting more for their money with a 440. For some reason, I think they're getting a better value having a 440 can than a 330.
Yeah.
So I mean, even like the MEV doesn't seem to come into it. So I mean, because like obviously we're all sort of we know we're a crack with like MEV and how duty works and things. It's like, well, if that's a 10 MEV, if I'm getting that in a 330 and put the 6% and 440, I'll probably go for the 330. Do you know what I mean? Like
I think that's something. It's like an education thing with the especially around the consumers, the publicans and the guys in the bottle shops and stuff. Initially, we're right, 500 mil bottle or nothing else. You know, we're not going to take cans. Nothing, 330 mil bottles won't cut it. Like, nobody wants to buy them.
Yeah.
But I think consumers are becoming more savvy and more educated, and more, you know, they're worried more about the flavor and not so much about the price point. Then it's become less of an issue for them. But initially, at the start, like it was 500 mil bottles or nothing else. That was pretty much.
It's what drove, like, you know, when we opened up. 4 or 5 years ago, that's why we're doing bottles basically. But you know, because that was what it was driving us, everyone was like, we want 500 ml bottles. And I'm glad, like, you know, now it's changed that way. And you know, I think I'd agree that the 440 ml can seems,
because
it's that good balance between, you know, you've got enough and you, for some of these stronger strength or not even stronger strength, but more like flavorful, like impact flavor beers, that's a good size for that. Especially for sharing too, I think, you know, it's enough to share a beer if you get a 10% barrel aged thing in a can, and you split it with someone. It's a good size for that.
Yeah, I could see a big difference on the drink as well, and as you said, the flavor. Like, I mean, I know, you know, the craft beers, but then sometimes I'll get the people send me, and I've got, you know, pint cans from Lithuania, say, but they're much weaker at the time, but they're nice. It's nice sometimes that pint and have a weaker difference between an espresso and, say, and a full cup of coffee. You know, sometimes you want that lasts a bit longer than that. But
especially in Ireland, I think we kind of guzzle beer a wee bit as well. So we're used to having like a pint and just sitting. Yeah. You know, you can have a go at it without, you know, two or three of them, and you're not going to be wobbly when you get up. But with craft beer, it's a bit different, especially with that stout that we did. It was like, you had one of them and you got up and it was like you're on a bouncy castle or something.
But you don't see it changing. By the way, Lair has opened his first of his rabbit hole. So he's
We're waiting for the progress updates.
Ryan just mentioned here, I didn't see it, I didn't know this, but Boundary seemingly had a did they have a beer they called works out as £8 a pint?
Somebody did that
one. I think the price thing is more relevant for draft, to be honest with you.
I think
it's a small pack concern, and certain beers are designed for selling on draft, and other ones just won't work. So,
Now, we don't really have to think about draft too much up here, because they're all tied. So.
Yeah,
well, it's the same down here. They're effectively tied down here, guys. I mean,
we're tied more. We're actually more tied.
You prove up there, don't you?
No, not legally. We have the bar occasional licenses.
It is legal.
So we've been lobbying Stormont. There's a bill at the minute, goes through Stormont. We've been working with the ICBI actually to see how the bill in the South worked and the outworkings of that, because the politicians here are very keen to look at the South rather than looking across at GB. We'd rather they looked at GB in terms of the tap rooms over there and how easy it is to get a license. So unfortunately, I won't look at GB because the island of Ireland, the legislation is so similar. They won't look at GB. But we're trying to lobby to allow us to have permanent tap rooms. But it looks like we're going to have something similar to what has happened in the South and with the 6 PM closing and things like that. Unless you get a full pub license, and a full pub license is at the minute it's incredibly difficult to get because nobody's selling a license because the government is paying all this money for people to keep their pubs closed. Yeah. Nobody wants to sell their license while they're getting all the funding from the government.
It's you have to extinguish your license up there the same as down here.
So I think the whole island, it goes back to 1902 or 1906 or something like that, and pre-partition. And it was the Prohibitionist movement, and it was an appeasement to the Prohibitionist movement to put a cap on the amount of licenses. And unfortunately, it hasn't moved on since then, so...
Yeah, we're all in the same boat, effectively.
Yeah. Oh, okay. All right. I feel your pain.
Is it the same with you guys? Because when we're applying for a taproom license up here, anytime we do a taproom license, we have to borrow an occasional license from a pub again, because each pub or each licensee has about 12 to 13 licenses per year.
Occasional
licenses. So then we have to borrow one of those licenses, bring it to the court, and then the court has to sign off on it, and then we can use that occasional license. And it takes about 2 weeks to probably do. So when you're actually advertising a taproom, you actually don't know if it's going to be or not. So you have to like wait before you can actually announce it, before it comes through. Is that something that you guys have to do as well if you're doing the taprooms like occasionally?
I haven't done one myself, so I can't tell you. But I think it sounds like it's the same. Yeah, same.
One we have here is we ended up just getting a restaurant license and we sell pizza.
So you have to sell basically
under that restaurant license, we end up selling. We sell here so we can serve beer.
Yeah,
and the issue is that
because it was just too much to. Yeah. That way, so it's a pizza oven, and that's the only thing we offer is pizza.
Yeah, that's the same. Walled City up in Derry, that their tap room is basically a restaurant, just where you can get your like tasting platters and stuff as well. So it is like dressed up like a tap room, but it's basically a restaurant just so they can get by them. But it's, so it's ridiculous. Like
the issue is that though is you have to get planning permission for a restaurant, and then you have to get pay your rates as a restaurant. So you're not, you know, you it might be a manufacturing facility, but you have to zone a certain aspect or portion mm-hmm. Of this facility as a restaurant, which rates on a restaurant are a lot higher, obviously. So it's difficult. Maybe you have to run a kitchen and all that. So it's
definitely the answer.
We were getting, I know maybe it's the same up there. Well, I suppose the thing we have down here is you can get a producer's retail license so you can sell the beer yourself directly.
We can't do that, but the bill going at the minute is to allow us to bring us into line with the site to allow us to do that.
Yeah, which would be, it would go some way, you know, it'd be a bit of a help definitely to be able to do that, but still, it's not exactly like the dream scenario, but we'll take it, you know, absolutely.
Yeah, any improvement is an improvement, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Listen, guys, I won't hold you in any longer. We had all the technical issues at the start. But we got over those, so hopefully everybody had fun. I enjoyed it, and I'm sure we could keep going for hours, but you can go back and open your own beers before they start going off in the best before dates. Well, listen,
I want to stay on here and see when Lara comes on again in about an hour.
Lara, one last go. Raise your hand there, and we'll find find him. No, I think he's disappeared, actually.
He's gone, he's down the rabbit hole.
He's gone, that's it. So that's good stuff. If you've been listening to this, you probably enjoy visiting a brewery and trying to, you know, tour it, learn who the people are who make the beers, see how they do it, and just get to know the local of the specifics of that particular brewery. You've probably also found out that it's quite difficult to identify which brewers allow visitors. Many don't because they don't have space, they don't have time. A lot of breweries are gypsy brewers, they don't have their own facilities. So trying to dig all that out can be quite hard. That's why I set up breweryvisits.eu. It's a directory of brewers that allow and welcome visitors. You know, it might be that they have set up tours, you know, kind of tours arranged, or that you can just call them and they're quite happy to show you around. It's still growing. We have about 300 brewers in there out of about thousands that I went through. So if you're interested in actually finding a brewer to visit when you're traveling around Europe, then check out breweryvisits.eu.